Chapter 33. Bly leaned over the stained wash basin toward the mirror and rearranged his face. He placed a prosthesis made from white foam rubber latex over his battered nose, lengthening the tip and raising the bridge. The false addition was kept in place by spirit gum and tinted with a special makeup for coating rubber. His reshaped beak was dusted with a bit of translucent powder to remove the shine. His original eyebrows had been plucked out. He peeled away their replacements and began attaching crepe hair with the spirit gum, dabbing the tiny tufts in place with tweezers. The new brows were arched higher and thickened to a bushier look. He paused and stood back a few moments, comparing his handiwork with the photographs taped to the lower edge of the mirror. Satisfied with his progress, he took a highlight makeup a few shades darker than white and drew it from a point on the chin along the jawline to a point under each ear. Next, a low-light earth tone was blended under the chin. The finished artistry gave his oval jaw more of a squared, chiseled appearance. He realigned his mouth by covering it with a base makeup and then brushing a line under the lower lip with a matching colored lipstick so that it seemed fatter and more protruding. The contact lenses followed. This was the only part he detested. Changing the color of his eyes from brown to gray was like changing his soul. He could no longer distinguish Foss Gly under the disguise after the lenses went in. The final touch was the brown wig. He lowered it over his nude head with both hands as though it were a crown. At last, he stood back and scrutinized full face and profiles while holding a small lamp at different lighting angles. It was near perfect, he judged, as near perfect as possible, considering the primitive conditions in the dingy bathroom of the Fleabag Hotel where he was registered. The night clerk was not at the desk when he passed through the lobby. Two side streets and an alley later, he sat behind the wheel of a Mercedes-Benz sedan. He had stolen it from the parking lot of a bank earlier that afternoon and switched the license plates. He drove through the old section of Quebec City called Lower Town, hugging the curbing of the quaint narrow streets and honking at the occasional pedestrian, who gave way only after fixing Gly with a belligerent stare. It was a few minutes past nine, and the lights of Quebec sparkled on the ice lingering over the St. Lawrence. Gly passed below the famed Chateau Frontenac Hotel and swung onto the expressway bordering the river. The traffic moved along rapidly, and soon he was abreast of the battlefield park on the Plains of Abraham, where the British Army triumphed over the French in 1759 and gained Canada for the Empire. He turned off into the fashionable suburban community of Sillery. Great stone houses sat ageless and fort-like, protecting the wealthy and social celebrities of the province. Gly could not identify with security. To him, the houses looked like monstrous crypts inhabited by people who did not know they were dead. He stopped at a heavy iron gate and identified himself to a speaker. There was no reply. The gate swung open, and he drove up a circular drive to an imposing granite mansion surrounded by several acres of lawn. He parked the car under the front portal and rang the door chime. Premier Jules Garrier's chauffeur bodyguard bowed Gly into the foyer. "Good evening, Monsieur Vion. This is an unexpected pleasure." Gly was pleased. His facial alteration had passed its first test. "I was visiting friends in Quebec and thought I would drop by and pay my respects to Monsieur Garrier. I'm told he isn't feeling well." "About with the flu," said the chauffeur, taking Gly's coat. "The worst is over. His temperature has dropped, but it will be a while before he can get back in harness again. If he's not up to a late visit, perhaps I should run along and call tomorrow." "No, please, the Premier is watching television. I know he'll be glad to see you. I'll take you up to his room." Gly waved him off. "Don't bother, I know the way." He went up the vast circular staircase to the second floor. At the top, he paused to orient himself. He had memorized the plans for the entire house, fixed every exit in his mind as a precaution for hurried escape. Garrier's bedroom, he knew, was the third door on the right. He entered quietly without knocking. Jules Garrier was slouched in a large overstuffed chair, slippered feet propped on an ottoman, peering at a television set. He was wearing a silk paisley robe thrown carelessly over his pajamas. He didn't notice Gly's intrusion. His back was to the door. Gly moved silently across the carpet to the bed. He picked up a large pillow and approached Garrier from behind. He started to lower the pillow over Garrier's face, but he hesitated. He must see me, Gly thought. His ego needed to be pacified. He had to prove to himself again that he could indeed become Henri Villon. Garrier seemed to sense a presence. He turned slowly and his eyes came level with Gly's beltline. They trailed up his chest to his face, and then they widened, not from fear, but from astonishment.
Henri?
Yes, Jules.
You can't be here, Garrier said dumbly.
Gly moved around behind the television set and faced the premier.
But I am here, Jules. I'm right here inside the TV.
And so he was. An image of Henri Villon filled the center of the screen. He was making an address at the opening of Ottawa's new Performing Arts Center. Daniel Sarveau was seated behind him, and next to her was Villon's wife. Garrier was unable to comprehend, to fully conceive what his eyes reflected to the cells of his brain. The broadcast was live. He had no doubt of it. As a formality, he had received an invitation and recalled the scheduled events of the ceremony. Villon's speech was set for now. He stared into Gly's face, his jaw slack in shock.
How?
Gly did not answer. In the same motion, he straddled the chair and pressed the pillow into Garrier's face. The beginning of a terrified cry became scarcely more than a muffled animal sound. The premier had little strength for the uneven struggle. His hands found Gly's thick wrists and feebly tried to pull them away. His lungs felt as if they ignited into a ball of flame. Just before the final darkness, a great blaze of light burst in his head. After 30 seconds, the hands loosened their grip and fell away, dangling awkwardly over the armrests of the chair. The aging body went limp, but Gly maintained the pressure for another 3 full minutes. Finally, he turned off the TV set, bent down and listened for a heartbeat. All life functions had ceased. The Premier of Quebec was dead. Swiftly, Gly crossed the room and checked the hall outside. It was empty. He returned to Garrier, removed the pillow, and threw it back on the bed. Gently, to keep from causing a tear in the fabric, he removed the robe and laid it over the back of the chair. He was relieved to see that the premier had not wet himself. Next came the slippers. They were casually dropped beside the bed. Gly felt no disgust, not even the smallest measure of distaste, as he picked up the corpse and placed it on the bed. Then, with clinical composure, he forced open the mouth and began probing. The first thing a police pathologist examined if he suspected induced asphyxiation was the victim's tongue. Garrier had cooperated. His tongue bore no teeth marks. There were, however, slight indications of bruises inside the mouth. Gly took a small makeup kit from his pocket and selected a soft pinkish grease pencil. He could not make the discolorations disappear completely, but he could blend them in with the surrounding tissue. He also darkened the paleness around the interior of the lips, removing another hint of suffocation. The eyes stared unseeing, and Gly closed them. He massaged the contorted face until it took on a relaxed, almost peaceful expression. Then he fixed the body in a restful position of sleep and pulled up the bed covers. A tiny nagging doubt ticked in the back of his mind as he walked from the bedroom. It was the doubt of a perfectionist who always sensed a detail undone, an indefinable overlooked detail that refused to focus. He was descending the upper flight of stairs when he saw the bodyguard emerge from the pantry carrying a tray with a porcelain teapot. Gly stopped in mid-step. He abruptly realized an oversight that he should have realized before. Garrier's teeth were too perfect. It dawned on him that they must have been false. He crouched out of vision of the approaching bodyguard and ran back to the bedroom. 5 seconds and he held them in his hand. Where did the old man keep them until morning? He must soak them in a cleaning solution. The bedside table was bare except for a clock. He found a plastic bowl filled with blue liquid on the bathroom counter. There was no time for him to analyze the contents. He dropped in the dentures. Gly opened the bedroom door just as the bodyguard was reaching for the knob from his side in the hall. Oh, Monsieur Villon, I thought you and the Premier might like some tea. Gly nodded over his shoulder toward the lump on the bed. Jules said he felt tired. I think he was asleep as soon as his head hit the pillow. The bodyguard took his word for it. Would you like a cup before you leave, sir? Gly closed the door. Thank you, no. I must be getting along. They returned to the foyer together. The bodyguard set down the tray and helped him into his coat. Gly lingered on the threshold, making certain Guerrier's man saw the Mercedes. He bid a good night and started the car. The gate opened and he swung onto the deserted street. 8 blocks away, he parked at the curb between 2 large homes. He locked the doors and stomped the ignition key into the ground with his heel. What could be more common than a Mercedes-Benz sitting in a stylish residential district, he figured. People who lived in mansions seldom talked to their neighbors. Each would probably think the car belonged to friends visiting next door. The car would be ignored for days. Gly was on a bus back to Quebec at 10 past 10. The exotic poison he had concocted was still in his pocket. It was a foolproof method of murder used by the Communist Intelligence Service. No pathologist could detect its presence in a corpse with certainty. The decision to use the pillow was a spur-of-the-moment afterthought. It seemed a fitting tool for Gly's fetish for inconformity. Most murderers followed a pattern, developed a routine modus operandi, preferred a particular weapon. Gly's pattern was that he didn't have one. Every kill was completely different in execution from the last. He left no strings to connect him with the past. He felt a flush of excitement. He had cleared the first hurdle. One more remained, the trickiest, most sensitive one of them all.